You can't know how Rollin King, a San Antonio businessman, hatched the idea to take what Pacific Southwest was doing in California and bring it to Texas, to start an airline that flew short-haul flights between Dallas, Houston and San Antonio. He had recently gone through a long and messy divorce and turned to the one man he trusted to help him get his idea off the ground. His wild turkey drinking, chain-smoking divorce lawyer, Herb Kelleher. In nearly every way, King and Kelleher were opposites. King, a numbers guy, was notoriously gruff and awkward, while Kelleher was gregarious and likable. At first Kelleher called King's idea a dumb one, but by the end of the evening King had successfully inspired him with his vision and Kelleher agreed to consider coming on board. It would take 4 years, however, before Southwest 76. Clarity, Discipline and Consistency Airlines would make its first flight from Dallas's Love Field to Houston. Southwest did not invent the concept of a low-cost airline. Pacific Southwest Airlines pioneered the industry, Southwest even copied their name. Southwest had no first movers advantage, Braniff International Airways, Texas International Airlines and Continental Airlines were already serving the Texas market, and none was eager to give up any ground. But Southwest was not built to be an airline. It was built to champion a cause. They just happened to use an airline to do it. In the early 1970s, only 15% of the traveling population traveled by air. At that rate, the market was small enough to scare off most would-be competitors to the big airlines. But Southwest wasn't interested in competing against everyone else for 15% of the traveling population. Southwest cared about the other 85%. Back then, if you asked Southwest whom their competition was, they would have told you, "We compete against the car and the buzz." But what they meant was, "We're the champion for the common man." That was why they started the airline. That was their cause, their purpose, their reason for existing. How they went about building their company was not a strategy developed by a high-priced management consultancy. It wasn't a collection of best practices that they saw other companies doing. Their guiding principles and values stemmed directly from their why and were more common sense than anything else. In the 1970s, air travel was expensive, and if Southwest was going to be the champion for the common man, they had to be cheap. It was an imperative. And in a day and age when air travel was elitist, back then people wore ties on planes, as the champion for the common man, Southwest had to be fun. It was an imperative. In a time when air travel was complicated, with different prices depending on when you booked, Southwest had to be simple. If they were to be accessible to the other 85%, then simplicity was an imperative. At the time, Southwest had two price categories, nights/weekends and daytime. That was it. Cheap, fun and simple. That's how they did it. That's how they were to champion the cause of the common man. They were to champion. The result of their actions was made tangible in the things they said and did, their product, the people they hired, their culture and their marketing. "You are now free to move about the country," they said in their advertising. That's much more than a tagline. That's a cause. And it's a cause looking for followers. Those who could relate to Southwest, those who saw themselves as average Joes, now had an alternative to the big airlines. And those who believed what Southwest believed became fiercely loyal to the company. They felt Southwest was a company that spoke directly to them and directly for them. More importantly, they felt that flying Southwest said something about who they were as people. The loyalty that developed with their customers had nothing to do with price. Price was simply one of the ways the airline brought their cause to life. Howard Putnam, one of the former presidents of Southwest, likes to tell a story of a senior executive of a large company who approached him after an event. The executive said he always flew one of the big airlines when he traveled on business. He had to, it was a company mandate. And although he had accumulated many frequent flyer miles on the other airline and money was no object, when he flew for himself or with his family, he always flew Southwest. He loves Southwest, Putnam says with a grin when he tells the story. Just because Southwest is cheap doesn't mean it only appeals to those with less money. Cheap is just one of the things Southwest does that helps us understand what they believe. What Southwest has achieved is the stuff of business folklore. As a result of why they do what they do, and because they are highly disciplined in how they do it, they are the most profitable airline 78. Clarity, discipline and consistency in history. There has never been a year that they didn't turn a profit, including after September 11th and during the oil crises of the 1970s and early 2000s. Everything Southwest says and does is authentic. Everything about them reflects the original cause King and Kelleher set out to champion decades earlier. It has never veered. Fast forward about 30 years. United Airlines and Delta Airlines looked at the success of Southwest and decided they needed a low-cost product to compete and share in Southwest's success. We got to get as one of those, they thought. In April 2003, Delta launched their low-cost alternative, Song. Less than a year later, United launched TED. In both cases, they copied how Southwest did it. They made TED and Song cheap, fun and simple. And for anyone who ever flew TED or Song, they were cheap, they were fun and they were simple. But both failed. United and Delta were both old hands in the airline business and were every bit qualified to add whatever products they wanted to adapt to market conditions or seize opportunities. The problem was not with what they did, the problem was, no one knew why Song or TED existed. They may have even been better than Southwest. But it didn't matter. Sure, people flew them, but there are always reasons people do business with you that have nothing to do with you. That people can be motivated to use your product is not the issue, the problem was that too few were loyal to the brands. Without a sense of why, Song and TED were just another couple of airlines. Without a clear sense of why, all that people had to judge them on was price or convenience. They were commodities that had to rely on manipulations to build their businesses, an expensive proposition. United abandoned its entry into the low-cost airline business just 4 years after it began, and Delta's Song also took its last flight only 4 years after it launched. It is a false assumption that differentiation happens in how and what you do. Simply offering a high-quality product with more features or better service or a better price does not create difference. Doing so guarantees no success. Differentiation happens in why and how you do it. Southwest isn't the best airline in the world. Nor are they always the cheapest. They have fewer routes than many of their competition and don't even fly outside the continental United States. What they do is not always significantly better. But why they do it is crystal clear and everything they do proves it. There are many ways to motivate people to do things, but loyalty comes from the ability to inspire people. Only when the why is clear and when people believe what you believe can a true loyal relationship develop. Manipulation and inspiration are similar, but not the same. Manipulation and inspiration both tickle the limbic brain. Aspirational messages, fear or peer pressure all push us to decide one way or another by appealing to our irrational desires or playing on our fears. But it's when that emotional feeling goes deeper than insecurity or uncertainty or dreams that the emotional reaction aligns with how we view ourselves. It is at that point that behavior moves from being motivated to inspired. When we are inspired, the decisions we make have more to do with who we are and less to do with the companies or the products we're buying. When our decisions feel right, we're willing to pay a premium or suffer an inconvenience for those products or services. This has nothing to do with price or quality. Price, quality, features and service are important, but they are the cost of entry in business today. Doing business is like dating. I'd like to introduce you to our imaginary friend Brad. Brad is going on a date tonight. It's a first date and he's pretty excited. He thinks the woman he's about to meet is really beautiful and that she makes a great prospect. Brad sits down for dinner and he starts talking. I am extremely rich. I have a big house and I drive a beautiful car. I know lots of famous people. I'm on TV all the time, which is good because I'm good looking. I've actually done pretty well for myself. The question is, does Brad get a second date? The way we communicate and the way we behave is all a matter of biology. That means we can make some comparisons between the things we do in our social lives and the things we do in our professional lives. After all, people are people. To learn how to apply why to a business situation, you needn't look much farther than how we act on a date. Because, in reality, there is no difference between sales and dating. In both circumstances, you sit across a table from someone and hope to say enough of the right things to close the deal. Of course, you could always opt for a manipulation or two, a fancy dinner, dropping hints of tickets that you have or whom you know. Depending on how badly you want to close the deal, you could tell them anything they want to hear. Promise them the world and the odds are good that you will close the deal. Once. Maybe twice. With time, however, maintaining that relationship will cost more and more. No matter the manipulations you choose, this is not the way to build a trusting relationship. In Brad's case, it is obvious that the date did not go well. The odds are not good that he will get a second date, and he's certainly not done a good job of laying down the foundation to build a relationship. Ironically, the woman's initial interest may have been generated based on those elements. She agreed to go on the date because her friends told her that Brad was good looking and that he had a good job and that he knew a lot of famous people. Even though all those things may be true, what's don't drive decision making, what's should be used as proof of why, and the date plainly fell flat. Let's send Brad out again, but this time he's going to start with why. You know what I love about my life? He starts this time. I get to wake up every day to do something I love. I get to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. In fact, the best part is trying to figure out all the different ways I can do that. It really is amazing. And believe it or not, I've actually been able to make a lot of money from it. I bought a big house and a nice car. I get to meet lots of famous people and I get to be on TV all the time, which is fun, because I'm good looking. I'm very lucky that I'm doing something that I love. I've actually been able to do pretty well because of it. This time the chances Brad will get a second date, assuming that whoever is sitting across from him believes what he believes, went up exponentially. More importantly, he's also laying a good foundation for a relationship, one based on values and beliefs. He said all the same things as on the first date, the only difference is he started with why, and all the what's, all the tangible benefits, served as proof of that why. Now consider how most companies do business. Someone sits down across a table from you, they've heard you're a good prospect, and they start talking. Our company is extremely successful. We have beautiful offices, you should stop by and check them out sometime. We do business with all the biggest companies and brands. I'm sure you've seen our advertising. We're actually doing pretty well. In business, like a bad date, many companies work so hard to prove their value without saying why they exist in the first place. You'll have to do more than show your resume before someone finds you appealing, however. But that is exactly what companies do. They provide you with a long list of their experience, what they've done, whom they know, all with the idea that you will find them so desirable that you will have to drop everything to do business with them. People are people and the biology of decision-making is the same no matter whether it is a personal decision or a business decision. It's obvious that in the dating scenario it was a bad date, so why would we expect it to be any different in the business scenario? Like on a date, it is exceedingly difficult to start building a trusting relationship with a potential customer or client by trying to convince them of all the rational features and benefits. Those things are important, but they serve only to give credibility to a sales pitch and allow buyers to rationalize their purchase decision. As with all decisions, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it, and what you do serves as the tangible proof of why you do it. But unless you start with why, all people have to go on are the rational benefits. and chances are you won't get a second date. Here's the alternative. You know what I love about our company? Every single one of us comes to work every day to do something we love. We get to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. In fact, the fun part is trying to figure out all the different ways we can do that. It really is amazing. The best part is, it is also good for business. We do really well. We have beautiful offices, you should stop by sometime to see. We work with some of the biggest companies. I'm sure you've seen our ads. We're actually doing pretty well. Now, how certain are you that the second pitch was better than the first? 3 degrees of certainty when we can only provide a rational basis for a decision, when we can only point to tangible elements or rational measurements, the highest level of confidence we can give is, I think this is the right decision. That would be biologically accurate because we're activating the neocortex, the thinking part of our brain. At a neocortical level, we can verbalize our thoughts. This is what's happening when we spend all that time sifting through the pros and cons, listening to all the differences between plasma or LCD, Dell versus HP. When we make gut decisions, the highest level of confidence we can offer is, the decision feels right, even if it flies in the face of all the facts and figures. Again, this is biologically accurate, because gut decisions happen in the part of the brain that controls our emotions, not language. Ask the most successful entrepreneurs and leaders what their secret is, and invariably they all say the same thing: I trust my gut. The times things went wrong, they will tell you, I listened to what others were telling me, even though it didn't feel right. I should have trusted my gut. It's a good strategy, except it's not scalable. The gut decision can only be made by a single person. It's a perfectly good strategy for an individual or a small organization, but what happens when success necessitates that more people be able to make decisions that feel right? That's when the power of why can be fully realized. The ability to put a why into words provides the emotional context for decisions. It offers greater confidence than I think it's right. It's more scalable than I feel it's right. When you know your why, the highest level of confidence you can offer is, I know it's right. When you know the decision is right, not only does it feel right, but you can also rationalize it and easily put it into words. The decision is fully balanced. The rational what's offer proof for the feeling of why. If you can verbalize the feeling that drove the gut decision, if you can clearly state your why, you'll provide a clear context for those around you to understand why that decision was made. If the decision is consistent with the facts and figures, then those facts and figures serve to reinforce the decision. This is balance. And if the decision flies in the face of all the facts and figures, then it will highlight the other factors that need to be considered. It can turn a controversial decision from a debate into a discussion. My former business partner, for example, would get upset when I turned away business. I would tell him that a potential client didn't feel right. That would frustrate him to no end because the client's money was as good as everyone else's, he would tell me. He couldn't understand the reason for my decision and, worse, I couldn't explain it. It was just a feeling I had. In contrast, these days I can easily explain why I'm in business, to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. If I were to make the same decision now for the same gut reason, there is no debate because everyone is clear why the decision was made. We turn away business because those potential clients don't believe what we believe and they are not interested in anything to do with inspiring people. With a clear sense of why, a debate to take on a bad fit client turns into 86. Clarity, discipline and consistency, a discussion of whether the imbalance is worth the short-term gain they may give us. The goal of business should not be to do business with anyone who simply wants what you have. It should be to focus on the people who believe what you believe. When we are selective about doing business only with those who believe in our why, trust emerges. Part 3, Leaders Need a Following. The emergence of trust to say that most of the company's employees were embarrassed to work there was an understatement. It was no secret that the employees felt mistreated. And if a company mistreats their people, just watch how the employees treat their customers. Mud rolls down a hill, and if you're the one standing at the bottom, you get hit with the full brunt. In a company, that's usually the customer. Throughout the 1980s, this was life at Continental Airlines, the worst airline in the industry. I could see Continental's biggest problem the second I walked in the door in February of 1994. Gordon Bethune wrote in from Worst to First, the chief executive's first-hand account of Continental's turnaround. It was a crummy place to work. Employees were surly to customers, surly to each other, and ashamed of their company. And you can't have a good product without people who like coming to work. It just can't be done, he recounts. It just can't. Herb Kelleher, the head of Southwest for 20 years, was considered a heretic for positing the notion that it is a company's responsibility to look after the employees first. Happy employees ensure happy customers, he said. And happy customers ensure happy shareholders, in that order. Fortunately, Bethune shared this heretical belief. Some would argue that the reason Continental's culture was so poisonous was that the company was struggling. They would tell you that it's hard for executives to focus on anything other than survival when a company is facing hard times. Once we get profitable again, the logic went, then we will take a look at everything else. And without a doubt, throughout the 1980s and early 1990s, Continental struggled. The company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection twice in 8 years, once in 1983 and again in 1991. And managed to go through 10 courts in a decade. In 1994, the year Bethune took over as the newest CEO, the company had lost $600 million and ranked last in every measurable performance category. But all that didn't last long once Bethune arrived. The very next year, Continental made $250 million and was soon ranked as one of the best companies to work for in America. And while Bethune made significant changes to improve the operations, the greatest gains were in a performance category that is nearly impossible to measure, trust. Trust does not emerge simply because a seller makes a rational case why the customer should buy a product or service, or because an executive promises change. Trust is not a checklist. Fulfilling all your responsibilities does not create trust. Trust is a feeling, not a rational experience. We trust some people and companies even when things go wrong, and we don't trust others even though everything might have gone exactly as it should have. A completed checklist does not guarantee trust. Trust begins to emerge when we have a sense that another person or organization is driven by things other than their own self-gain. With trust comes a sense of value, real value, not just value equated with money. Value, by definition, is the transference of trust. You can't convince someone you have value, just as you can't convince someone to trust you. You have to earn trust by communicating and demonstrating that you share the same values and beliefs. You have to talk about your why and prove it with what you do. Again, a why is just a belief, hows are the actions we take to realize that belief, and what's are the results of those actions. When all three are in balance, trust is built and value is perceived. This is what Bethune was able to do. There are many talented executives with the ability to manage operations, but great leadership is not based solely on great operational ability. Leading is not the same as being the leader. Being the leader means you hold the highest rank, either by earning it, good fortune, or navigating internal politics. Leading, however, means that others willingly follow you, not because they have to, not because they are paid to, but because they want to. Frank Lorenzo, CEO before Bethune, may have been the leader of Continental, but Gordon Bethune knew how to lead the company. Those who lead are able to do so because those who follow trust that the decisions made at the top have the best interest of the group at heart. In turn, those who trust work hard because they feel like they are working for something bigger than themselves. Prior to Bethune's arrival, the 20th floor of the company's headquarters, the executive floor, was off limits to most people. The executive suites were locked. Only those with a rank of senior vice president or higher were permitted to visit. Key cards were required to get onto the floor, security cameras were ubiquitous and armed guards roamed the floor to eliminate any doubt that the security was no joke. Clearly, the company suffered from trust issues. One story handed down was that Frank Lorenzo would not even drink a soda on a Continental plane if he didn't open the can himself. He didn't trust anyone, so it is no great leap of logic that no one trusted him. It's hard to lead when those whom you are supposed to be leading are not inclined to follow. Bethune was very different. He understood that beyond the structure and systems, a company is nothing more than a collection of people. You don't lie to your own doctor, he says, and you can't lie to your own employees. Bethune set out to change the culture by giving everyone something they could believe in. And what, specifically, did he give them to believe in that could turn the worst airline in the industry into the best airline in the industry with all the same people and all the same equipment? In college I had a roommate named Howard Jerushimovitz. Now an attorney in Chicago, Howard learned from an early age about a very simple human desire. Growing up in the suburbs of New York City, he played outfield on the worst team in the Little League. They lost nearly every game they played, and not by small margins either, they were regularly annihilated. Their coach was a good man and wanted to instill a positive attitude in the young athletes. After one of their more embarrassing losses, the coach pulled the team together and reminded them, "It doesn't matter who wins or loses, what matters is how you play the game." Loses, what? It was at this point that young Howard raised his hand and asked, "Then why do we keep score?" Howard understood from a very young age the very human desire to win. No one likes to lose, and most healthy people live their life to win. The only variation is the score we use. For some it's money, for others it's fame or rewards. For some it's power, love, a family or spiritual fulfillment. The metric is relative, but the desire is the same. A billionaire doesn't need to work. Money becomes a way to keep score, a relative account of how things are going. Even a billionaire who loses millions due to poor decisions can get depressed. Although the money may have zero impact on his lifestyle, no one likes to lose. The drive to win is not, per se, a bad thing. Problems arise, however, when the metric becomes the only measure of success, when what you achieve is no longer tied to why you set out to achieve it in the first place. Bethune set out to prove to everyone at Continental that if they wanted to win, they could win. And most of the employees stuck around to find out if he was right. There were a few exceptions. One executive who once held up a plane because he was running late was asked to leave, as were 39 more of the top 60 executives who didn't believe. No matter how experienced they were or what they brought to the table, they were asked to leave if they weren't team players and weren't able to adapt to the new culture that Bethune was trying to build. There was no room for those who didn't believe in the new Continental. Bethune knew that building a team to go out and win meant more than giving a few rah-rah speeches and bonuses for the top brass if they hit certain revenue targets. He knew that if he wanted to build a real, lasting success, people had to win not for him, not for the shareholders and not even for the customer. For the success to last, the employees of Continental had to want to win for themselves. Everything he talked about was in terms of how it benefited the employees. Instead of telling them to keep the planes clean for customers, he pointed out something more obvious. Every day they came to work on a plane. The passengers left after their flight, but many of the flight attendants had to stay on for at least one more trip. It's just nicer to come to work when the environment is cleaner. Bethune also got rid of all the security on the 20th floor. He instituted an open-door policy and made himself incredibly accessible. It was common for him to show up and sling bags with some of the baggage handlers at the airport. From now on, this was a family and everyone had to work together. Bethune focused on the things they knew to be important, and to an airline the most important thing is to get the planes running on time. In the early 1990s, before Bethune arrived, Continental had the lowest on-time rating of the nation's 10 largest airlines. So Bethune told employees that each month Continental's on-time percentage ranked in the top 5, every employee would receive a check for $65. When you consider that Continental had 40,000 employees in 1995, every on-time month cost the airline a whopping $2.5 million, but Bethune knew he was getting a deal. Being chronically late was costing it $5 million a month in expenses like missed connections and putting passengers up overnight. But most important to Bethune was what the bonus program did for the company culture. It got tens of thousands of employees, including managers, all pointed in the same direction for the first time in years. Gone were the days when only the brass would enjoy the benefits of success. Everyone got their $65 when the airline did well, and no one got it when the airline missed its targets. Bethune even insisted that a separate check be sent out. It wasn't just added to their salary check. This was different. This was a symbol of winning. And on every check, a message reminded them why they came to work: thank you for helping make Continental one of the best. We measured things the employees could truly control, Bethune said. We made the stakes something the employees would win or lose on together, not separately. Everything they did made people feel like they were in it together. And they were. The only difference between you and a caveman is the car you drive. The reason the human race has been so successful is not because we're the strongest animals, far from it. Size and might alone do not guarantee success. We've succeeded as a species because of our ability to form cultures. Cultures are groups of people who come together around a common set of values and beliefs. When we share values and beliefs with others, we form trust. Trust of others allows us to rely on others to help protect our children and ensure our personal survival. The ability to leave the den to hunt or explore with confidence that the community will protect your family and your stuff until you return is one of the most important factors in the survival of an individual and the advancement of our species. That we trust people with common values and beliefs is not, in itself, a profound assertion. There is a reason we're not friends with everyone we meet. We're friends with people who see the world the way we see it, who share our views and our belief set. No matter how good a match someone looks on paper, that doesn't guarantee a friendship. You can think of it on a macro scale also. The world is filled with different cultures. Being American is not better than being French. They are just different cultures, not better or worse, just different. American culture strongly values ideals of entrepreneurship, independence and self-reliance. We call our why the American dream. French culture strongly values ideals of unified identity, group reliance and joie de vivre. Notice that we use the French word to describe the joy of life lifestyle. Coincidence? Perhaps. Some people are good fits in French culture and some people are good fits in American culture. It is not a matter of better or worse, they are just different. Most people who are born and raised in one culture will, for obvious reasons, end up being a reasonably good fit in that culture, but not always. There are people who grew up in France who never quite felt like they belonged, they were misfits in their own culture. So they moved, maybe to America. Drawn to the feelings they had for America's why, they followed the American dream and emigrated. It is always said that America is fueled in large part by immigrants. But it is completely false that all immigrants make productive members of a society. It's not true that all immigrants have an entrepreneurial spirit, just the ones that are viscerally drawn to America. That's what AY does. When it is clearly understood, it attracts people who believe the same thing. And assuming they are good fits for what Americans believe and how they do things, those immigrants will say of America, "I love it here," or "I love this country." This visceral reaction has less to do with America and more to do with them. It's how they feel about their own opportunity and their own ability to thrive in a culture in which they feel like they belong versus the one they came from. And within the big why that is America, it breaks down even further. Some people are better fits in New York and some are better fits in Minneapolis. One culture is not better or worse than the other, they are just different. Many people dream of moving to New York, for example, attracted to the glamour or the perception of opportunity. They arrive with aspirations of making it big, but they fail to consider whether they will fit into the culture before they make their move. Some make it. But so many don't. Over and over, I've seen people come to New York with big hopes and dreams, but either couldn't find the job they wanted or they found it but couldn't take the pressure. They are not dumb or bad or poor workers. They were just bad fits. They either stay in New York and exert more effort than they need to, hating their jobs and their lives, or they move. If they move to a city in which they are better fits, Chicago or San Francisco or somewhere else, they often end up much happier and more successful. New York is not rationally better than other cities, it's just not right for everyone. Like all cities, it's only right for those who are good fits. The same can be said for any place that has a strong culture or recognizable personality. We do better in cultures in which we are good fits. We do better in places that reflect our own values and beliefs. Just as the goal is not to do business with anyone who simply wants what you have, but to do business with people who believe what you believe, so too is it beneficial to live and work in a place where you will naturally thrive because your values and beliefs align with the values and beliefs of that culture. Now consider what a company is. A company is a culture. A group of people brought together around a common set of values and beliefs. It's not products or services that bind a company together. It's not size and might that make a company strong, it's the culture, the strong sense of beliefs and values that everyone, from the CEO to the receptionist, all share. So the logic follows, the goal is not to hire people who simply have a skill set you need, the goal is to hire people who believe what you believe. Finding the people who believe what you believe. Early in the 20th century, the English adventurer Ernest Shackleton set out to explore the Antarctic. Roald Amundsen, a Norwegian, had only just become the first explorer ever to reach the South Pole, leaving one remaining conquest, the crossing of the continent via the southernmost tip of the Earth. The land part of the expedition would start at the frigid Weddell Sea, below South America, and travel 1,700 miles across the pole to the Ross Sea, below New Zealand. The cost, Shackleton estimated at the time, would be about $250,000. The crossing of the South Polar Continent will be the biggest polar journey ever attempted, Shackleton told a reporter for the New York Times on December 29, 1913. The unknown fields in the world which are still unconquered are narrowing down, but there still remains this great work. On December 5, 1914, Shackleton and a crew of 27 men set out for the Weddell Sea on the Endurance, a 350-ton ship that had been constructed with funds from private donors, the British government and the Royal Geographical Society. By then, World War I was raging in Europe, and money was growing more scarce. Donations from English schoolchildren paid for the dog teams. But the crew of the Endurance would never reach the continent of Antarctica. Just a few days out of South Georgia Island in the southern Atlantic, the ship encountered mile after mile of pack ice, and was soon trapped as winter moved in early and with fury. Ice closed in around the ship like an almond in a piece of toffee, a crew member wrote. Shackleton and his crew were stranded in the Antarctic for 10 months as the Endurance drifted slowly north, until the pressure of the ice floes finally crushed the ship. On November 21, 1915, the crew watched as she sank in the frigid waters of the Weddell Sea. Stranded on the ice, the crew of the Endurance boarded their three lifeboats and landed on Tiny Elephant Island. There Shackleton left behind all but five of his men and embarked on a hazardous journey across 800 miles of rough seas to find help. Which, eventually, they did. What makes the story of the Endurance so remarkable, however, is not the expedition, it's that throughout the whole ordeal no one died, there were no stories of people eating others and no mutiny. This was not luck. This was because Shackleton hired good fits. He found the right men for the job. When you fill an organization with good fits, those who believe what you believe, success just happens. And how did Shackleton find this amazing crew? With a simple ad in the London Times. Compare that to how we hire people. Like Shackleton, we run ads in the newspaper, or on the modern equivalents, Craigslist or Monster.com. Sometimes we hire a recruiter to find someone for us, but the process is largely the same. We provide a list of qualifications for the job and expect that the best candidate will be the one who meets those requirements. The issue is how we write those ads. They are all about what and not about why. A want ad might say, for example, account executive needed, minimum 5 years experience, must have working knowledge of industry. Come work for a fantastic, fast-growing company with great pay and great benefits. The ad may produce loads of applicants, but how do we know which is the right fit? Shackleton's ad for crew members was different. His did not say what he was looking for. His ad did not say, men needed for expedition. Minimum 5 years experience. Must know how to hoist mainsail. Come work for a fantastic captain. Rather, Shackleton was looking for those with something more. He was looking for a crew that belonged on such an expedition. His actual ad ran like this, men wanted for hazardous journey. Small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful. Honor and recognition in case of success. The only people who applied for the job were those who read the ad and thought it sounded great. They loved insurmountable odds. The only people who applied for the job were survivors. Shackleton hired only people who believed what he believed. Their ability to survive was guaranteed. When employees belong, they will guarantee your success. And they won't be working hard and looking for innovative solutions for you, they will be doing it for themselves. What all great leaders have in common is the ability to find good fits to join their organizations, those who believe what they believe. Southwest Airlines is a great example of a company with a knack for hiring good fits. Their ability to find people who embody their cause makes it much easier for them to provide great service. As Herb Kelleher famously said, you don't hire for skills, you hire for attitude. You can always teach skills. This is all fine and good, the problem is, which attitude? What if their attitude is not one that fits your culture? I love asking companies whom they like to hire, and one of the most common answers I am given is, we hire only passionate people. But how do you know if someone is passionate for interviewing, but not so passionate for working? The truth is, almost every person on the planet is passionate, we are just not all passionate for the same things. Starting with why, when hiring dramatically increases your ability to attract those who are passionate for what you believe. Simply hiring people with a solid resume or great work ethic does not guarantee success. The best engineer at Apple, for example, would likely be miserable if he worked at Microsoft. Likewise, the best engineer at Microsoft would probably not thrive at Apple. Both are highly experienced and work hard. Both may come highly recommended. However, each engineer does not fit the culture of the other's company. The goal is to hire those who are passionate for your why, your purpose, cause or belief, and who have the attitude that fits your culture. Once that is established, only then should their skill set and experience be evaluated. Shackleton could have had the most experienced crew money could buy, but if they weren't able to connect on a level much deeper than their ability, their survival would not have been a foregone conclusion. For years, Southwest didn't have a complaints department, they didn't need one. Though Kelleher rightly talked about the need to hire for attitude, the airline in fact deserves more credit for hiring the good fits responsible for providing great service. Kelleher was not the only one making the hiring decisions, and asking everyone to simply trust their gut is too risky. Their genius came from figuring out why some people were such good fits and then developing systems to find more of them. In the 1970s, Southwest Airlines decided to put their flight attendants in hot pants and go-go boots as part of their uniforms. Hey, it was the 1970s. It wasn't their idea. Pacific Southwest, the California-based airline after which Southwest modeled itself, did it first. Southwest simply copied them. Unlike Pacific Southwest, however, Southwest figured out something that would prove invaluable. They realized that when they recruited flight attendants, the only people who applied for the job were cheerleaders and majorettes. That's because they were the only people who didn't mind wearing the new uniforms. Cheerleaders and majorettes, however, fit in perfectly at Southwest. They didn't just have a great attitude, their whole disposition was about cheering people on. Spreading optimism. Leading crowds to believe that we can win. They were perfect fits at a company that was the champion of the common man. Realizing this, Southwest started to recruit only cheerleaders and majorettes. Great companies don't hire skilled people and motivate them, they hire already motivated people and inspire them. People are either motivated or they are not. Unless you give motivated people something to believe in, something bigger than their job to work toward, they will motivate themselves to find a new job and you'll be stuck with whoever's left. Give them a cathedral, consider the story of two stonemasons. You walk up to the first stonemason and ask, "Do you like your job?" He looks up at you and replies, "I've been building this wall for as long as I can remember. The work is monotonous. I work in the scorching hot sun all day. The stones are heavy and lifting them day after day can be backbreaking. I'm not even sure if this project will be completed in my lifetime. But it's a job. It pays the bills." You thank him for his time and walk on. About 30 feet away, you walk up to a second stonemason. You ask him the same question, "Do you like your job?" He looks up and replies, "I love my job. I'm building a cathedral. Sure, I've been working on this wall for as long as I can remember, and yes, the work is sometimes monotonous. I work in the scorching hot sun all day. The stones are heavy and lifting them day after day can be backbreaking. I'm not even sure if this project will be completed in my lifetime. But I'm building a cathedral. What these two stonemasons are doing is exactly the same, the difference is, one has a sense of purpose. He feels like he belongs. He comes to work to be a part of something bigger than the job he's doing. Simply having a sense of why changes his entire view of his job. It makes him more productive and certainly more loyal. Whereas the first stonemason would probably take another job for more pay, the inspired stonemason works longer hours and would probably turn down an easier, higher-paying job to stay and be a part of the higher cause. The second stonemason does not see himself as any more or less important than the guy making the stained glass windows or even the architect. They are all working together to build the cathedral. It is this bond that creates camaraderie. And that camaraderie and trust is what brings success. People working together for a common cause. Companies with a strong sense of why are able to inspire their employees. Those employees are more productive and innovative, and the feeling they bring to work attracts other people eager to work there as well. It's not such a stretch to see why the companies that we love to do business with are also the best employers. When people inside the company know why they come to work, people outside the company are vastly more likely to understand why the company is special. In these organizations, from the management on down, no one sees themselves as any more or any less than anyone else. They all need each other. When motivated by why, success just happens. It was a turn-of-the-century version of the dot-com boom. The promise of a revolutionary new technology was changing the way people imagined the future. And there was a race to see who could do it first. It was the end of the 19th century and the new technology was the airplane. One of the best known men in the field was Samuel Pierpont Langley. Like many other inventors of his day, he was attempting to build the world's first heavier-than-air flying machine. The goal was to be the first to achieve machine-powered, controlled, manned flight. The good news was Langley had all the right ingredients for the enormous task. He had what most would define as the recipe for success. Langley had achieved some renown within the academic community as an astronomer, which earned him high ranking and prestigious positions. He was secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. He had been an assistant in the Harvard College Observatory and professor of mathematics at the United States Naval Academy. Langley was very well connected. His friends included some of the most powerful men in government and business, including Andrew Carnegie and Alexander Graham Bell. He was also extremely well funded. The War Department, the precursor the Department of Defense, had given him $50,000 for the project, a lot of money in those days. Money was no object. Langley assembled some of the best and brightest minds of the day. His dream team included test pilot Charles Manley, a brilliant Cornell-trained mechanical engineer, and Stefan Bolzer, the developer of the first car in New York. Langley and his team used the finest materials. The market conditions were perfect and his PR was great. The New York Times followed him around everywhere. Everyone knew Langley and was rooting for his success. But there was a problem. Langley had a bold goal, but he didn't have a clear sense of why. His purpose for wanting to build the plane was defined in terms of what he was doing and what he could get. He had had a passion for aeronautics since a very young age, but he did not have a cause to champion. More than anything else, Langley wanted to be first. He wanted to be rich and he wanted to be famous. That was his driving motivation. Although already well regarded in his own field, he craved the kind of fame of a Thomas Edison or Alexander Graham Bell, the kind that comes only with inventing something big. Langley saw the airplane as his ticket to fame and fortune. He was smart and motivated. He had what we still assume is the recipe for success: plenty of cash, the best people and ideal market conditions. But few of us have ever heard of Samuel Pierpont Langley. A few hundred miles away in Dayton, Ohio, Orville and Wilbur Wright were also building a flying machine. Unlike Langley, the Wright brothers did not have the recipe for success. Worse, they seemed to have the recipe for failure. There was no funding for their venture. No government grants. No high-level connections. The Wright brothers funded their dream with the proceeds from their bicycle shop. Not a single person working on the team, including Orville and Wilbur, had a college education, some did not even finish high school. What the Wright brothers were doing wasn't any different from Langley or all the others trying to build a flying machine. But the Wright brothers did have something very special. They had a dream. They knew why it was important to build this thing. They believed that if they could figure out this flying machine, it would change the world. They imagined the benefits to everyone else if they were successful. Wilbur and Orville were true scientists, deeply and genuinely concerned about the physical problem they were trying to solve, the problem of balance and flight, said James Tobin, the Wright brothers' biographer. Langley, on the other hand, was consumed with acquiring the level of prestige of his associates like Alexander Graham Bell, fame that he knew would come only with a major scientific breakthrough. Langley, Tobin said, did not have the Wright's passion for flight, but rather was looking for achievement. Orville and Wilbur preached what they believed and inspired others in the community to join them in their cause. The proof of their commitment was self-evident. With failure after failure, most would have given up, but not the Wright brothers' team. The team was so inspired that no matter how many setbacks they suffered, they would show up for more. Every time the Wright brothers went out to make a test flight, so the stories go, they would take 5 sets of parts with them, because they knew that's how many times they were likely to fail before deciding to come home for the day. Then it happened. On December 17, 1903, on a field in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, the Wright brothers took to the sky. A 59-second flight at an altitude of 120 feet at the speed of a jog was all it took to usher in a new technology that would change the world. Remarkable as the achievement was, it went relatively unnoticed. The New York Times was not there to cover the story. Driven by something bigger than fame and glory, the Wright brothers were content to wait to tell the world. They understood its true significance to the world. What Langley and the Wright brothers were trying to create was exactly the same. Both were building the same product. Both the Wright brothers and Langley were highly motivated. Both had a strong work ethic. Both had keen scientific minds. What the Wright brothers' team had that Langley did wasn't luck. It was inspiration. One was motivated by the prospect of fame and wealth, the other by a belief. The Wright brothers excited the human spirit of those around them. Langley paid for talent to help him get rich and famous. The Wright brothers started with why. Further proof Langley was motivated by what. A few days after Orville and Wilbur took flight, Langley quit. He got out of the business. He could have said, "That's amazing, now I'm going to improve upon their technology." But he didn't. He found the defeat humiliating. His own test flight had landed in the Potomac River, and the newspapers all made fun of him. He cared so much about what others thought of him, he was so preoccupied with becoming famous. He wasn't first, so he simply quit. Innovation happens at the edges. Dream teams are not always so dreamy. When a team of experts comes together, they often work for themselves and not for the good of the whole. This is what happens when companies feel the need to pay mega salaries to get the best talent. Those people are not necessarily showing up because they believe in your why, they are showing up for the money. A classic manipulation. Paying someone a lot of money and asking them to come up with great ideas ensures very little. However, pulling together a team of like-minded people and giving them a cause to pursue ensures a greater sense of teamwork and camaraderie. Langley pulled together a dream team and promised them riches. The Wright brothers inspired a group of people to join them in pursuit of something bigger than each member of the team. Average companies give their people something to work on. In contrast, the most innovative organizations give their people something to work toward. The role of a leader is not to come up with all the great ideas. The role of a leader is to create an environment in which great ideas can happen. It is the people inside the company, those on the front lines, who are best qualified to find new ways of doing things. The people who answer the phones and talk to customers, for example, can tell you more about the kinds of questions they get than can anyone sitting in an executive suite miles away. If the people inside a company are told to come to work and just do their job, that's all they will do. If they are constantly reminded why the company was founded and told to always look for ways to bring that cause to life while performing their job, however, then they will do more than their job. Steve Jobs, for example, did not personally come up with the iPod or iTunes or the iPhone. Others inside the company did. Jobs gave people a filter, a context, a higher purpose around which to innovate, find existing status quo industries, those in which companies fight to protect their old-fashioned business models, and challenge them. This is why Apple was founded. It is what Jobs and Wozniak did when they started the company, and it is what Apple's people and products have done ever since. It's a repeating pattern. Apple's employees simply look for ways to bring their cause to life in as many places as they can. And it works. It is not the same at many other companies. Companies that define themselves by what they do instead of why they do it instruct their people to be innovative around a product or service. Make it better, they are instructed. Those who work for Apple's competitors, companies that have defined themselves as computer manufacturers, come to work to develop more innovative computers. The best they can do is add more RAM, add a feature or two, or, as one PC maker has done, give people the option to customize the color of their computer casing. This hardly qualifies as an idea with the potential to change the course of an industry. A nice feature, for sure, but not innovation. If you are curious as to how Colgate finds itself with 32 different types of toothpaste today, it is because every day its people come to work to develop a better toothpaste and not, for example, to look for ways to help people feel more confident about themselves. Apple does not have a lock on good ideas. There are smart, innovative thinkers at most companies. But great companies give their people a purpose or challenge around which to develop ideas rather than simply instruct them to make a better mousetrap. Companies that study their competitors in hopes of adding the features and benefits that will make their products better are only working to entrench the company in what it does. Companies with a clear sense of why tend to ignore their competition, whereas those with a fuzzy sense of why are obsessed with what others are doing. The ability of a company to innovate is not.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.